From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
Basically, the cats didn't observe social distancing, and so the kittens kept arriving.
If you're in Hollywood and you're hearing, "What about you?" You're going, "What did he say?" He said, "What about you?" But I don't understand that.
It's kind of the prospect of a big operation and a little baby can be terrifying.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, when taking the plunge and getting married gets you very wet indeed, why the wild cats are taking over, and the man with the unpronounceable job title talks about his new book with the very easily pronounced title. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that welcomes our new feline overlords. We'll start with the newsings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty show, and what seems like the quiet introduction of the sort of thing that could lead to, well, Judgment Day. Where should we look for this?
Singapore. I'm going to go to Singapore first.
Why Singapore?
Because they are trialling robots, patrol robots, to deter bad social behaviour.
Ah, okay. The rise of the machines. Armed to the teeth, pick up your litter, or be summarily executed. That sort of thing, I suppose.
The robots go round. Singapore has started trialling robots to patrol public areas and deter poor social behaviour in its latest effort to further augment its strong portfolio of surveillance tools. What's that mean as language? A strong portfolio of surveillance tools. Sounds like a police state masquerading as a beautifully put sentence. Ranked one of the safest countries in the world, because you probably can't do anything else anyway, it has put two autonomous robots on trial to detect bad behaviour, such as flouting of COVID-19 safety measures, which sounds very 6 weeks ago, smoking in prohibited areas, and the improper parking of bicycles. Well, you wouldn't relax, really, in Singapore, would you, if parking a bike in the wrong rack is going to cause you a robot coming up going, "Please don't punch your bike there." What? "Please don't punch your bike there." Well, it's because there's no, "Please don't punch." There's no reasoning with the robot. I mean, this is like when you go into the phone system and it says, you know, "Please hold," and you're there for hours and hours and hours trying to get through to a human voice. Just one. Press one. You know, this is an old one, but it's true. Press one if you want to talk about something you have no interest in ringing about. Press two if you want to talk about something even less relevant to the thing you're ringing about. Press three, it goes on. Press 78 if you want to, or hold for an operator. Well, I've been here for an hour and a half, but I'll hold, and I want to speak to a human being. Anyway, the robots are taking over. It's all happening in Singapore. I wouldn't have minded if they have a little thing that says, "Please don't spit in public." I got two of them yesterday. I would have sent the robot off to one guy, and it was one of those long ones where his head was bent over and it was long, and it was taking it forever to actually leave the mouth. And then the other one was more of a quick, it was like a sniper. It was like, gone. But the long one just took forever, it seemed, to expel from his mouth. But no robots. So maybe in due course.
Stay with Ryan if you want to live. Meanwhile, Northern Ireland's own Kenneth Branagh has a new movie about his hometown coming out. Will you be watching it or reading it?
Kenneth Branagh's Belfast upcoming film should come with subtitles, leading Hollywood publication claims. Kenneth Branagh, who's one of my favourite guests I think I've met, a total gentleman, a very nice fella, and a great actor and a great director. Independent.ie reporting that Kenneth Branagh's upcoming film, Belfast, should come with subtitles, as some of the actors' accents are difficult to understand, according to a leading Hollywood publication. Well, that's okay. Accents in any country, especially if they're in English. It's like this thing, Baptiste, for example. And I enjoyed the original one, which I think, was that in French? I'm not sure. Either way, it's very good. The leading actor is very good, fine actor. But for whatever reason, the latest edition, Fiona Shaw's in it, and of course she's a knockout in anything she does, really. But unfortunately, the leading actor in Baptiste, his accent is, he is playing the French detective whose English is super, but slightly irritating because it is constantly, thinking of the next word. And you think, okay, that's great, and all in your English is super, but I'd actually rather have your beautiful French and a good subtitle than a struggle through your accented English. That's what I would say. But I'm wrong. Because it's doing well, and but it's just a bit of a drag. And Kenneth Branagh's Belfast accents will in his TV by the movie that he's making. I understand why they didn't need that. Broadly speaking, it's not an anti-Belfast thing. It's just a matter of fact. If you're in Hollywood and you're hearing, "What about you?" You're going, "What did he say?" He said, "What about you?" He said, "Well, I don't understand that." And equally, somebody from Belfast will say, "Well, I don't understand the guy on the radio talking in Dublin." This is it. It's just, and anyway, nowadays, the subtitle thing allows you to get over that either way. I can't understand what a lot of Americans are saying, and they're speaking English, apparently. So you put on the subtitles.
Alas, we've no subtitles on the radio, but we might have quacks.
Ducks. Ducks usually confine themselves to quacking when communicating with prospective friends or rivals. However, to Australia now, where one Australian fowl developed a more unusual call. This is a musk duck. Ripper, the musk duck, was hand-reared by humans, you see, near Canberra. And in the wild, the musk duck lives in a large group, and the males learn the species' characteristic high-pitched whistles from the older flock members. So far, who cares? We keep going. Without these influences, Ripper, the musk duck, replicated the human-made sounds it heard in its formative weeks, which included door slamming, well done, human coughing, COVID-unfriendly, and speech. So what speech have we got? Well, it seems that the duck has now swapped the whistle for a human voice that it can now replicate through its bill and says the following. Now, I'll play that again because you're thinking, that just sounds like... Well, if I get... This could be the power of suggestion. This could be like Peter Kay's sketch with the songs and the lyrics. What they're saying is, the duck has heard the human saying the words, you bloody fool, so many times that that's what the duck is saying. And the jury is out on duck speak. In fact, I'd have a full duck gate on the inquiry on that one.
A something gate where you could just eat the main witness could have major ramifications for film and television dramatists everywhere. But from Duckgate to that thing the young people do on their personal computers.
In other news, well done to Happier News, the Meath YouTubers, whose company recorded almost 1 million in revenue. I mean, the YouTube phenomenon is just that. That you can go on YouTube and say, this is how Minecraft works, or here's how you can build a bigger wall, or whatever it is so popular. And they're working it, and that is to say, monetizing it, so professionally and so well that you can only take your hat off and say fair play. So these guys, Ryan and Scott Fitzsimons, last year topped pretty much £1 million. They're the Minecraft millionaires. And they uploaded their first Minecraft video in June 2012. And today their Little Lizard Adventure channel boasts 4.1 million subscribers, according to breakingnews.ie. And over the past 9 years, the channel has been viewed 2.63 billion times. It's a whole generation of... I mean, when we were kids, we'd sit down, and if you're lucky, with your glass of my waddy and your piece of cake or biscuit, whatever it might have been, you'd sit there and watch whatever TV was on. Now YouTubers have changed the whole face of children's television and children's viewing habits entirely. It's extraordinary. So fair play to the lads from Meath. Meath having a great week so far, and it's only Tuesday.
Yeah, lucky Meath. But moving on quickly, when a listener texts in with an update on how Singapore deals with robots who spit, Ryan gets all nostalgic for flying.
Ryan, there are signs all over Singapore and Hong Kong, public transport and public places. Please do not spit, says Eamon. Really, I've never been. I've never been to too many places. Does that make sense? Even this morning I was saying, I think I'm ready to fly again. Today was the first day I thought, and I'm not going to lie to you, when I saw Leo Varadkar at the concert thing, whatever, the Wigfield gig he was at, I thought, I'm not making a comment about him, whether he goes or not is his business. He did nothing illegal. I thought, that's okay then. So we're all good to go. And I'm not having a snark. I just thought, well, that's okay if the tarnished is flying and we can all, and I really meant that. I thought, well, I'm ready to get going now. And I know loads of people are doing it anyway. The airports are jammed. And I really feel now it's I'm pretty much ready to go. I'm considering packing it back. Now that the Late Late's back, I have no time to go anywhere, so I won't be going anywhere. But in my head, in my fantasy island head, I was thinking, yeah, I could do with a cold beer somewhere nice. Not now. I mean, not even by the sea, just near it.
And that's where we'll leave the newsings from this morning's Tuberty Show, lazing in the vicinity of the sea with a cold beer. Until the robots come and take action for drinking in the open air. Now, you may remember the proposed state commemoration of the Royal Irish Constabulary, which caused some consternation in pre-pandemic days. Well, it's back. But it's been shunted to the UK and is now planned for St Paul's Cathedral in London next April. The commemoration was discussed on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne by Michael Clifford, special correspondent for the Irish Examiner, and Cathal Crowe, Fianna Fáil TD for Claire.
Mick, I'll start with you. You say we're just too immature to have this event in Ireland.
Well, that would seem to be the case, Claire. I mean, as you said, this was originally scheduled to take part on in January 2020. Now, it should be said that holding that as the first commemorative event in what would have been a seminal year of centenary commemorations was probably a major misstep, because it was always going to be somewhat sensitive. But notwithstanding that, the furore that blew up around it and was driven to a large extent on social media, but not exclusively, following Cathal Crowe's decision not to attend it, that led to its postponement and ultimately its cancellation. And it would seem that despite 100 years passing, we are not mature enough to accept that the RIC were part of our society here and were an integral part of policing, notwithstanding that period was during the time the country was ruled by the British. Mm-hmm. It should be pointed out, the RIC began in 1836 and it was disbanded in 1922. That's 85 years. There was about 85,000, nearly all men, served in it. And you're talking about people drawn from all strata of society up and down the country. For example, the likes of Tom Barry's father was in it, Sean O'Fallon, the writer, his father was in it. One of the founding committee of the GAA was an RIC inspector. So these were not, except in the last 18 months of its incarnation, when you had the likes of the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries brought in from the UK. Apart from that, you can argue whether or not they were really part of the RIC. But apart from that, for good or ill, mm-hmm. they were certainly a part of our country here for the 85 years leading up to independence.
Yeah, but you say that, but you also write today that this was a police force that was never regarded with affection or respect and ended up on the wrong side of history. And that's the problem, isn't it?
It is. The fact that, when I say it was never regarded with affection or respect, I think that's in general terms, in terms of how the police would have been regarded generally, particularly as they were seen as representatives of the Crown. Notwithstanding, as I say, they were drawn from the community. But the main thing is they ended up on the wrong side of history, and therefore they are to be forgotten. And this plays into a version of history that is very black and white, that is good guys and bad guys. The RIC in this respect were bad guys. Yes, they were involved in some atrocities, and some of their members during the revolutionary period did behave appallingly. But so too, that was the case for those who were involved in the IRA of the day as well.
Right, let's see what Cathal Crowe has to say about this, because you make a serious charge against the Fianna Fáil TD. You say he made his stance and before you could say hop aboard, his bandwagon was full to the brim. Cathal, what do you say?
Yeah, well, good morning. Thank you for having me on air. Look, can I just say at the outset, I want to begin with that bandwagonism attribute that was in Mick Clifford's article this morning, because this is anything but. If I wasn't at TD, I would be in my classroom this morning teaching history. I take my history very seriously. I blog about it. It's part of my everyday life. So let's go back a little bit. The RIC was formed in 1836. He's very correct in that. And 85,000 did serve in it throughout its lifetime. Only 13 of them transferred onto an Garda Síochána. And it's factually incorrect and wrong and misleading, in fact, to say that this force only went rogue in its last 18 months or so. If you go back through history, yes, you had the gentleman officer who, you know, strode about a village and pushed his pushbike and kept law and order. But there was also subversive. I suppose in Ireland there was a whole independence movement starting. There was Landy. There was a whole lot of things going on in the late 1800s, even just up the road from my own home place. In 1887, there were the Badaig evictions, which were beautifully colourised photographs just a few months ago. This force, from its very inception, wasn't just keeping law and order and keeping the drunks coming home to the pub. This was to subvert the Irish will for independence right throughout. They were also a murdering force. They were at Bloody Sunday in 1920. They were the murder squad for Mayor Tomás McCurtain on the 20th of March 1920. This was a force that had many good individuals, but to whitewash them as an entire entity is wrong. The government recognised that following a stance they took. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Yeah, the commemoration now being proposed is the right way.
Yeah, but you see, if somebody, if they're trying to whitewash them, as you say, and you know, the commemoration which was planned for 2020, you say was going to do that. That's why you didn't attend. You're doing the opposite. You're doing the opposite by outlining all of the incidents that marred their history.
No, there are many good individuals. I have an RIC officer's whistle in my office. I love history. And that whistle belonged to an officer in my community that is still spoken about in high esteem. It's different to start looking at an entire organisation, however, and using the instruments of the state, the army brass band, laying reeds and having our heads of state, leading a commemoration. Leading is very different. History is nuanced, and so is commemoration. And I consider, and many do consider, commemoration to be an act of celebration. The way it's happening now, I think it's far more appropriate. It's akin to what the Royal British Legion would have in terms of their commemorations every November the 11th, where they will hold it, they will host it, and they will invite state dignitaries.
And do you think it's appropriate that government representatives and the Garda Commissioner, if they decide to go, that they do go? Do you think that's the right thing for them to do?
I have no issue. I have attended in the past commemorations where I've been invited. It is very different for the state to lead one. That is bestowing an act of celebration and honour and a force that tried to subvert Dáil Éireann and subvert the state and was a murder squad as well.
What do you say to that, Mick? This is the right way to do it.
Yeah, it's a matter of opinion. But I mean, Claire, this notion, of course, the RIC suppressed various elements of the independence movement down through the years. But to the largest extent, unfortunately, and we know this because it was part of the raison d'etre for the 1916 Rising, there's a large element of apathy about independence among large tracts of the community. We forget that now. Now you can have millions of people who were in the GPO in 1916. So to pit the RIC against the Irish people per se as such is a distortion as well. I've made it plain, I'm not defending anything the RIC did. I have no affinity with the organisation. But I'm saying it would be an acknowledgement of history and of the fact that they were there to acknowledge that this was the case. One can take in a similarly brief period of during the Civil War. Some of the atrocities that were committed there were absolutely appalling. And we have no compunction about commemorating those who fought on either side in the Civil War. The other element that arises with the whole thing, of course, is it's also a one-eyed view of history and in terms of what this island represents, because at the same time that you have various elements doing, attempting, and it's a perfectly legitimate aspiration, to have a united Ireland, they're saying to those unionists in the north, we cannot allow commemoration of an organisation that you might have identified with, notwithstanding it's 100 years old.
Yeah, Carl Crowe, you want to come back in there?
Yeah, if I could just come in there. This all began with a slur of immaturity, and I think that's very offensive to those of us who practice history. And most of the most eminent historians of Ireland have come in behind this position that has been taken now by the state. The British government's own commemorative committee decided this was too hot an issue to go at themselves. So we as a country 2 years ago were looking at state commemoration when the British themselves weren't prepared to commemorate.
Cathal Crowe, Fianna Fáil TD for Clare, debating the Irish Examiner's special correspondent Michael Clifford over a state commemoration of the RIC on this morning's Today with Clare Byrne. Anita and Dom took the plunge this weekend, literally. The pair, who are currently honeymooning in Lisbon, spoke to Ray Darcy this afternoon about, well, jumping into the sea in their wedding apparel.
Now, listen, this is brilliant because it's gone a bit mad, isn't it? Your little... So, Anita, whose idea was it and why?
Well, we swim in the sea, basically 40-foot sea point, Killiney, as much as we can, usually.
Yeah.
And before lockdown, I had a big party, birthday, and the next day we all went for a swim, and loads of my friends got in who'd never been in before, and they were all coming back again to Dublin for the wedding, and Dom had mentioned taking the plunge, and I was like, well, if we're going to take the plunge, we should really go for it.
Yeah. Right, and then Dom, what did you say to that suggestion?
Oh, sure. Every day when Anita is an adventure, I just go along with it.
It's not like that at all, right? He was completely involved in everything.
But I'd say, you know, in going swimming attire, that a wedding dress is probably the least practical, Anita.
It is pretty unpractical.
Yes.
But it was absolutely hilarious to do it in the wedding dress. It added an extra element of exhilaration I had felt in years.
So you got married on Saturday, as I was saying, in Dunleary, and then did you announce at the wedding that you were going to do this on Sunday?
No, no. So as part of the wedding invitation, we said 40-foot dip the day after, if weather allowed.
Right, okay.
So we had a lot of friends and family who were coming, even if they didn't swim before, brought their togs just in case they were going to get in that day.
Yeah, yeah. You had a beautiful day
for us. We didn't say anything about the dress.
Brilliant. Yeah, because it's up there on your Instagram, and it's just a really joyful 20 or 30 seconds where you walk up into position holding hands. And then there's no dilly-dallying, not too much dilly-dallying, holding hands, you jump in, and there's a shriek from you, Anita, is there? When you hit the water?
There is. Well, there's no dilly-dallying because, very fortunately, the photographer, who's a college friend of mine, said, we're going to jump in the day after. Yeah. And he said, look, if I'm around, I'll come down. And he went for a swim himself and brought his camera. So that's the only reason we had a photographer there. And he took a few shots. And once you're down the 40-foot with a wedding dress on and a suit, everyone is just like, what is going on? They all just stopped and stared and started saying congratulations. It's really lovely, actually. Yeah. And as we headed up to jump off, people were like, she's going to fall in if she takes a picture up there. She's going to fall in.
Yes.
And then we just went for it. Yeah, I've never jumped off that high bit before, so that was probably why I shrieked.
isn't that brilliant? So yeah, it was amazing. A first. It was a first.
Yeah, it was for me anyway. I've never jumped off that before.
Because I know I don't want to get too much into the symbolism of it all, but you know, they talk about getting married as taking the plunge, and you did this literal taking the plunge thing, but you were doing it for the first time, which most people get married, it's for the first time, most people. So there's a lot of like you could definitely write a paper on this, the symbolism of it all.
Well, I had the biggest laughing fit after I got out of the water. I think I was just hyper from the whole thing. Yeah. Fortunately, we had, and just to mention, because I wouldn't advise anyone going ahead and doing this on a regular basis, we had friends in the water who were really, really strong swimmers.
Great.
We also had advice about the dress. I had a safety pin underneath it so that it wouldn't go completely over my head and it wouldn't show everyone next week's washing.
That's a lovely phrase.
We have some people just helping us in case, for any reason, I didn't come back up.
I'm just intrigued as to where you get advice on jumping from the 40-foot in a wedding dress. It's not something that a lot of people would have done before.
We happened to have someone who was a guest at the wedding who actually managed it. She's a coordinator for stunts.
Okay, right. Look at you.
So she actually was like, I have a safety pin. I'll be there.
Right. And when you get in, because there's a lot of dress in a wedding dress, and yours was no different. So I'd imagine it naturally just comes up and maybe, you know, did it cover your head or something? What happened?
No, fortunately, with this little trick of the safety pin,
it kept it down. Yes,
but
yeah.
Swimming out was a little bit difficult. I have to go backwards because I couldn't move forward with the trick.
Right. And Dom, you'd done it before, Adji. You'd jumped from that height.
Yeah, but not. I hadn't gotten married before. friends of ours, we jump in all the time. Obviously, when the tide is safe to do so, lovely spot there. Lovely spot.
Yeah. And you have the pictures and you have the video and you can play it in slow-mo. What a wonderful...
It's so funny.
Go on.
Oh, it's amazing. And because we got up early this morning for a flight out of Dublin, and then when we landed into Lisbon, we turned on our phones and they just exploded. They were like, hey, people are sharing your photographs and all this. And we were like, oh, that's nice. Next thing, you know. But it's great to be able to spread the joy. Joy is the word that comes to mind when I saw the photographs. We were genuinely, we weren't even aware of, people taking photographs and stuff. Lots of people then came up to us afterwards and said, oh, we got shots of you jumping in and stuff. So
yeah.
That's Dom and Anita from their honeymoon suite telling Ray Darcy about their 40-foot post-wedding jumping adventures. Who are misses? Colin Black has the sort of job that a lot of people, including Ryan Tuberty, have difficulty pronouncing. So he wrote a book with a much simpler title.
What is your job?
So I'm a consultant pediatric anesthesiologist.
And in English?
Or an anesthetist. So I, in sort of layman's terms, I knock out children for surgery, basically. So yeah, I work in Crumlin Children's Hospital. I specialise mostly in anaesthesia for congenital heart disease. So I've trained in Ireland and also in Great Ormond Street Hospital in the UK. So yeah, I put children to sleep for more or less every operation that they need.
When you study medicine, you studied, before you did medicine, you did...
I did 1 year of physiotherapy, decided it wasn't for me, and then I switched over to study medicine, both in UCD. Yeah.
Intriguing, today being CAO form-filling day, that you're one of those people who jumped mid-race. Why did you do that?
Correct. Well, I mean, I was a bit naive as to what physiotherapy was. I felt it was just going to be picking up Premiership footballers off the pitch, but it turns out there's a lot more to physiotherapy than that. So sort of halfway through the year, I decided that I was going to change. And the subjects I enjoyed the most in physiotherapy were the ones that the medical students were also studying. So at that stage, halfway through my first year in university, was literally the first time I ever considered being a doctor and studying medicine. Yeah. So I would encourage anyone who's filling in their CAO today to put the things you like first, and don't be put off if you don't enjoy your first year in university. There's always time to switch over to something else.
That is reassuring for people. Take what you've got today and see what happens. And you went into medicine then, and I think you found your groove pretty straight away.
Yeah, I loved it.
You knew where you wanted to be.
Loved it straight away. Yeah, absolutely.
And then when you're in the medical world, of course, you get to a point where you get this, if you will, selection box of careers within the medical world. You want to be a GP, psychiatry, neurology, and on it goes. Mm. You alighted on anesthesiology.
Correct, yeah.
I keep trying to get that right, but you relied on that. Why, of all the choices?
Well, you're sort of one of two people doing medicine. You're either, you go into it because you know exactly what you want to do. Mm. My dad was a surgeon, I want to be a surgeon, or something like that. Or you go in with a sort of general idea of wanting to help people and science subjects. So it's very much a process of elimination. If you imagine remember that board game Guess Who, and everything's flicked up and okay, I don't like that, flip that one down, flip that one down, and then you're left with sort of what's appealing to you at the end. And I was kind of left with three things. I liked cardiology, I liked emergency medicine, and anesthesia. And the thing that appealed to me most about anesthesia was it's quite an exciting subspecialty. It's very logical, it's very rational, it's something that appeals to people who like that way of thinking. You know, there's very, you give a drug and it does that, and you do this and then that happens. So it's very instant gratification is a large part of it.
It's like it's Vulcan.
Yes. And you've got, you know, there's procedural elements to it as well. And we do a lot of things that other doctors don't do in terms of, putting in various epidurals or big lines that no one else can do. And, very much involved in resuscitating people in the emergency department and working in the intensive care. So all those things together, and then ruling out everything else, I decided that anesthesia was the one for me.
And digging deeper again, you get into that world, and then pediatrics. Why the children's?
Yeah, so I mean, kids are just, it's just so much fun working in a kids' environment. We have to do a lot of training in adults, and only a small portion of our training is actually in pediatrics. But going into a children's hospital, you can just feel the atmosphere is different. Mm. It's more challenging in some ways than working in adult practice. And I don't mean that we're better anaesthetists by any means, but there's a lot of, a lot of healthy adults going for very simple operations. It can all be quite straightforward. And yes. I guess I wanted to terrify myself every now and again.
I was going to say, the suggestion being with the adults one, by and large, might be a little unchallenging, a little boring.
Well, of course, older people are people with lots of comorbidities going for major surgery. That certainly poses a challenge in the adult world. But in kids, their physiology is a little bit different. They can be tricky to anaesthetize. They have lots of major operations. But even if you have a simple, straightforward operation in a perfectly healthy child, half the job is trying to coax them into the anaesthetic room and actually permit you to put them asleep. So you're never bored. It's never boring. You every small thing becomes a challenge within the kids' hospital in a good way, because they're great fun. And some of the things they ask you and some of the things they expect of your job are quite interesting, you know.
Kind of sounds like the Toy Show meets the Hunger Games.
It's something like that, yeah. You have to be, I see you do the Toy Show, and you have to be quite good with your age-appropriate banter. You know, one thing works for a toddler that doesn't work for someone, and you run the risk of completely embarrassing yourself in front of a teenager if you get it wrong.
Right. So how do you equip yourself for that? As you say, you need to be age-appropriate with your coaxing.
Yeah.
So how do you stay on top of that? Because can I ask you how old you are? I asked my guest yesterday the same question. So.
I'm 37.
Okay.
Yeah. So I only have an 18-month-old daughter now, so I'm just getting the hang of what actually 18-month-olds want to do. And, you know, some of the things I may have been doing before probably missed the mark. So I took a lot of, you know, my senior colleagues that trained me, you know, I'd observe them and see, okay, what are they doing that works for them? And then you try and create your own little environment for the kids or your own way of coaxing them into the anesthetic room. So, you know, you have to keep up with, you know, sort of things that kids enjoy, I suppose. Yeah. And sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes we need to give kids a pre-medication to just chill them out a little bit before we bring them in, because it doesn't matter what you're going to say, they're not going
to
come in.
So you have to play it. I mean, you're a conductor with an orchestra.
Exactly, yeah. And now it's a team effort. Now the nurses are great with them as well. So, but I'm kind of the final step before they get to go asleep, yeah.
You talk about liking the challenge, and small babies, the stakes are high. They're often very sick in Crumlin and so on. Are you terrified?
No. So it's kind of the prospect of a big operation in a little baby can be terrifying, but you just have to rely on your experiences and rely on your training and know that you have all the skills that you require to do this operation and this anesthetic. I mean, it's the same as, I presume, the first time you presented the Late Late Show, you might have been terrified, but you built up to that slowly throughout your career.
Yeah, I still get nervous, by the way.
But the first time you did it, it was probably like, that's a relief now. Yes. And then the next time you do it, that's a little bit easier. And then the next time, it's a little bit easier. So I think the more you do these high-risk procedures in high-risk children, the easier it gets. So it doesn't, the challenge doesn't disappear, but it comes a little bit easier over time, you know.
You've confronted the most awful sights in the world, which is a child that doesn't make it through an operation. Talk to me a little bit about, because I've got two things here in this sense, Colin. One is going into the operation knowing that the odds are not good, and then two, the result is fatal, and ultimately you have to deal with all of that. Talk to me about those two things.
Well, I don't want to terrify anyone about anaesthesia. So, I mean, anaesthesia is super, super safe, and the vast, vast majority of people get through their anaesthetic okay. Now, you are obviously at times confronted with a extremely sick person for an extremely high-risk operation. So you have to be able to put that to the back of your mind a little bit and just focus on doing the best you can during an operation. It's exceedingly rare for somebody to die in an operating theatre. Generally speaking, you get through the operation, and the intensive care unit is where a lot of these conversations happen. So fortunately, I don't have to do a lot of those life and death conversations. My colleagues in the intensive care unit and my colleague who spoke to last week, Suzanne Crow, would be very well versed in those sort of conversations. So you just, it helps me to sort of rationalize it and go, okay, there's a 10% risk of mortality here, maybe there's a 20% risk, and just use that as a logical way of approaching things, so that if there is a bad outcome afterwards, I don't ruminate too much on it, or I don't you know, fixate on it for too long, because sometimes the best care that you're given, the best job I do, the best job the surgeon does, the best job the intensive care physicians do, you know, still has a bad outcome sometimes. And it's just part of the job.
That's paediatric anesthesiologist Colin Black discussing his job and his new book, Gas Man, with Ryan Tiberty this morning. CAO first round offers were made today, and on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, Claire was joined by Niamh Dwyer, Guidance Counsellor and Chairperson of the Kerry branch of the Institute of Guidance Counsellors. The first point Claire put to Niamh was that demand for places is high and points are high.
So there's two things contributing really to the fact that the points will probably go up, Claire, and that is that we have more applicants this year. So we had 84,000 applying this year, where it was 78,000 last year. And then, of course, the results on Friday, which we saw an increase again, means that there is going to be an increase in points, certainly in the high-demand courses.
OK, and we have more places available to try and help with that demand.
We do. There's 4,650 have been allocated across high-demand areas like nursing, pharmacy, medicine, science, law, media, etc. But I suppose you are still going to have some students disappointed.
Yeah, there will be a shortfall.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the first round CAO offers, as I said, they'll be available at 2 o'clock in just a couple of hours. Will you just talk us through, Niamh, the offer process, what's going to happen?
Yeah, so students will receive their offer by email and by text, and can also log on to CAO.ie My Application, where they will be asked for their CAO number, date of birth and password. So they'll view what they have been offered and obviously can accept the offer if they wish. In fact, many do it quite quickly, but they do have time to wait and think about their options. It is important to watch for the reply dates. So there's an awful lot of dates this week for students, Claire, so it can be really, really confusing for them. So in relation to the CAO, whatever offer they get, they have until the 13th of September. So they have until next Monday at 3 o'clock to accept that offer. If they haven't accepted it at that stage, it will lapse. So that's, I suppose, the critical one in relation to CAO.
Okay.
Outside of that, they have other deadlines, but it might be better to chat about the CAO to begin with.
Yeah.
One of the biggest questions that students will have is, you know, if they accept, for example, their third course on their list, can they be offered? Can they get something else in the second round? So the second round will come out on the 20th of September, and the answer is that students can get offered something that is higher up on their order of preference, but they will never be offered something that was below what they have been offered already.
So that presents a danger point for people who might have been offered their first choice, but now they've decided, actually, the second choice was the one I wanted, so I'm going to wait. That's not advisable.
That won't work. And I suppose important to point out that students may, in fact, get two offers today because there are two different lists, Claire. Level 8 for the higher level degrees and level 7 and 6. So in that case, they need to choose one. They can only accept one offer.
Okay, and so now coming back to the different rounds. So you have until next Monday to accept. When then will you get your round two offer, Niamh?
So the round two offers then are out on the 20th of September at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the turnaround time is very tight. That must be replied to by 3 o'clock on the 22nd of September. Round three then comes out on the 28th of September, and again it's a two-day turnaround. Reply date there, the 30th of September. There's a round four on the 5th of October, and there's a round five actually on the 12th of October. So it keeps going until the places are filled.
So you mentioned some of the other dates that students will have to consider. Let's talk about those now, because there will be some people considering having a paper rechecked, and there are some key dates they need to keep in mind.
There are. So from this evening at 5 o'clock, Claire, students can log on this time to the candidate self-service portal on examinations.ie. And they'll get access to all their data. So last Friday, they got one set of results, the best set. So now they're going to get access to all of the information behind that. So how they did in the different parts of the written exams that they did, their accredited grades, you know, what they would have gotten in the accredited grade process, etc. So they can view that data, and it's really important that students do that and then have a think about whether or not they'd like to review their scripts. So if they're disappointed with the result, they can apply to review their scripts via the portal up to 8 o'clock on Wednesday. So that's a really tight deadline for them as well. So that's 8 o'clock tomorrow evening.
So the student has to make the decision then, having read over their script, whether they think it's worth having it rechecked or not.
Exactly. And so they'll get the option to view those scripts in the schools if they were corrected by examiners, you know, by hand, on the Saturday the 11th and Sunday the 12th. And then they'll be available online for any scripts that were marked online. They'll be available online from 9 o'clock as well on Saturday up to the Sunday deadline. So after they have seen the scripts, and it's really important that students look at them, because students, while they can be upgraded on appeal, they can also be downgraded.
Mm-hmm.
So if they wish to go ahead with an appeal, then they must apply for that by the 13th of September.
And if they are upgraded, Niamh, and if they're then eligible for a higher preference choice on the CAO, will they get that place this year, this academic year, or will they have to wait until September, October 2022?
So they will have to be offered the place in a subsequent round by CAO, but it really will be down to maybe the student and the college at that stage, because I suppose if you think of it, Claire, most colleges are back this week. And we will have first years starting, you know, in a couple of weeks' time. So if the student feels it might actually be better to wait and get it as a deferred place, but that would be done on a case-by-case basis.
The tangled web of CAO offers dropped today, as navigated for us by Guidance Counsellor Niamh Dwyer on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Thanks to the pandemic, there has apparently been an increase in the feral cat population of Ireland. Cyrilline Power of Cats Aid spoke to Philip Boucher-Hayes, sitting in for Joe Duffy, on this afternoon's Live Line about the problem and why lockdowns made it worse.
Well, basically, the cats didn't observe social distancing, and so the kittens kept arriving. And I don't think that people realise just how prolific cats can be. A female kitten can have her first litter when she's only about 5 months old, and then she can continue breeding from there on. So the kittens that keep arriving, and then people don't neuter and spay, and so the problem gets out of hand.
So one cat could, by the end of the year, foreseeably have given rise to another maybe 15 or more cats and so on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we sometimes, in Cats Aid, we sometimes get people contacting us and they are actually dealing with three generations of cats. So the problem should have been addressed with the first generation. Because groups can help if you have one or two stray cats in your garden. But when it's 10, 20 cats, it's far more difficult.
And where there is a problem, there is always somebody looking to make a fast buck. So tell me about these rogue cat catchers.
Well, we haven't had any direct experience of this, but we have seen items online and people posting on Facebook and that, and neighbourhood communities warning that cats have been disappearing around their area, or that cats have been poisoned. And obviously putting down poison is illegal, but people still do it. Sometimes these would-be groups who are rounding up the cats, or they might be just local residents who are simply fed up with the cat population.
But there are those that we have heard about travelling around in white vans, offering to neuter the cats, Maria, but taking them away and just relocating them to the Dublin Hills.
Oh, yes, indeed. Or sometimes they might not even relocate them. They might kill them. Just I won't call it putting them to sleep, because their methods are not always very humane. We have heard stories of these vans and cats being gassed.
Good Lord, really?
Mm. Part of the problem is that cats don't have protection under the law. So basically, you can kind of do whatever you like with cats.
Oh, but they must have. Do they not have protection from cruel treatment?
Dogs do, but cats not so much. Cats are still basically regarded as feral. And it's extremely difficult to get a conviction for cruelty.
Really? Even if you were to do something absolutely unhumanly cruel to a cat, you're saying that it's much, much less likely to be prosecuted than if you had done the same thing to a dog?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's go back to the feral cat problem, though, Cyrilline, because, all right, the last thing that they need to be done is gassed in the back of a white van, or thrown out of the back of the white van as it travels at speed through the Sally Gap or wherever it is. But there is an issue here with having to get the feral cat population under control. How would you deal with it?
Well, all the rescue groups will all say the same thing. The way forward is trap, neuter, return. And that means going to a colony, humanely trapping the cats, bringing them to a vet, getting them neutered or spayed, and whatever vet treatment might be necessary. And then, if they are healthy, returning them to their location.
And why not just trap and euthanise?
Well, if you cull a complete colony, you get what's called the vacuum effect, and other cats will simply move in and take over. So the ideal situation is to have a small, stable colony that have been neutered and spayed and that are healthy, and then have a few people keeping an eye on them, putting some food out for them, and the cats serve the purpose of rodent control. and they will stop other cats moving in.
But when those neutered cats do eventually shuffle off this mortal coil, does the same thing not happen? Does that space not end up being filled by other feral cats anyway, and all you have done is sustain the population of the feral cat in the area for a few more years?
Well, that's true, but up to a point, yes. Yes,
But still, you, in Cat's Aid would say, no, a cull is not the answer here.
No, definitely not, no.
Well, who's making the arguments for the birds here, though, Cyrilline? Because I did a brief bit of research on this, and I can't stand over these numbers. But it was suggested not that long ago that the cat population, both domestic and feral in Ireland, is 700,000 cats. And looking at a test that was done in a university in the United States where they put little kitty cat monitors on them to see how many birds they would kill in a night, that basically, long story short, you apply this study to Ireland, the cats are killing up to 4 million birds a year, and some of these are endangered species.
Right, well, that's a huge number, certainly, absolutely. But generally speaking, if people have cats and if there are birds around the area, we would suggest keeping the cats in, say, at the time that the birds feed in the morning, and then again at the time that the birds come home to roost at night. And very often, I think the birds that the cats catch would be fledglings, maybe, or birds that have been hurt or injured, and birds which probably wouldn't survive.
Marion Fitzgibbon.
I do see where people are coming from.
The pandemic-inspired feral cat boom in Ireland, as discussed on this afternoon's Liveline. Broadcaster Marion Finucane died in January last year. One of her great passions was getting women out of poverty and back to education. For years, Marion presented the prizes for An Cosán, the Centre for Learning in Jobstown in Dublin, which caters for those who are disadvantaged and never got an opportunity to get a proper education. John Clark, Marion's husband, joined Claire Byrne in studio to talk about making sure his late wife's legacy lives on.
First thing I'm going to ask you is, how are you?
I'm good. I came through a bad, dark place and then I opened my eyes and the world is still the same and the world still goes on and all its horrors and for me all its interests and fascinations, you know.
Because
and I have 40 years great memories.
Of course. And you know, I was at Marion's funeral that day and I just remember vividly the eulogy that she gave, which moved us all so much. But right after that, within a couple of months of Marion's death, we were into COVID, lockdown, not being able to see people. Did that impact you and what you were going through at that time?
Oh, Lord, yeah. It was the longest winter I ever spent. It was cold, it was wet, it was dreary, and night came at 4:30 and you were looking at the walls and your neighbours couldn't call and see you, you know, or nobody. I found it dreadful. That's probably very good for me in ways, you know, that you have to settle down and sort of ask who you are, what you are, what's it all about. I have no answers, by the way. I found life terribly random. Births and deaths, they're all random, you know. And I suppose it's trying to cope with the randomness of it that I find interesting, I'd say, is the best word. I had a loss. I had nobody to talk to. In the way I normally talk to Marion, anyhow, you know.
That's the thing about grief, isn't it? There's no way around it.
No. I discovered that. And I never knew I would lose so much. You know, I've been round death. You know, I lost a daughter. Tragedy, all that. But this was really different, you know. You know, there's somebody that answers the question you don't ask. I make the cup of tea or head for the kitchen and somebody says, I love one too. Mm-hmm. Nobody says anything, but they're all talking at the same time. I miss that, you know, big time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we ran Africa for the sake of arguing from our kitchen table, which occupied nights and nights and nights. We also discussed lots of the people she was about to interview or had interviewed, normally described in four-letter words from time to time.
Now you tell us.
And, you know, she was I presume, I don't know, I mean, you know more about this than I do. There's a public persona of a broadcaster, and then there's a very private life of a broadcaster, you know. Mm. And
well, Marion lived a very private life. I mean, we didn't know much about Marion's life, really. When I say we, I mean the public in general. She came in and she did her job. She did her job very well. That was it. Then she went off and had her life with you and with the rest of the family and friends.
Yeah.
Private person.
She was a terribly shy person, you know. I mean, I remember Marion used to have to appear at various things, and in her high heels, she was 6'1".
Mm-hmm.
And she used to be Nell McCafferty for protection, and Nell is 4 foot nothing, you know. And she said, I hide behind Nell. And I said, you know, they don't want to go to Specsavers if they can't see you, you know. But she's a very private person, and then I think she wanted to be terribly modest, you know. I mean, we did quite a lot of work in Africa, you know. I think we ended up with somewhere between 20 and 25,000 children, you know. Which is a lot of kids over the years. And if you said it, she said, no, don't talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because people would think she was boasting or blowing her trumpet. So never came across, you know.
When someone dies, we often look for signs, or we look for reasons why, or we try and say to ourselves, are they there? Can I feel them? Are they in the house? I mean, do you get any comfort from things like that? Or do you just have to deal with that bereft, empty notion that she's gone?
Well, I talked to her a bit, you know, but not a lot. I had 40 plus years of a great life, a really great life with Marion. We travelled the world, we did all sorts of things. We shacked down in bizarre railway stations in and out of various wars, here, there, everywhere, you know. And I don't think we ever had a row, but we chattered all the time. And it was bizarre sort of talk and bizarre places, and we led, I suppose, a different life to lots of people. You know, we were always skint and all that sort of stuff, you know, but and I miss that, and I miss a companion that can talk to me. But I had 40 years of great. And when this COVID thing gets over, whenever, I intend to throw a party of fun for her and our mates, you know.
So it sounds like you've reached a point where you can appreciate the 40 years.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I always did. Because I try as hard as I can to live in the now, you know. Like, getting me terrified here in this bloody studio and so on. But, you know, whatever it is, do it now. And, you know, no good telling somebody you love them when they're dead. No point in God's world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So tell them today.
What would she think of you being in here now today?
She would agree with the idea that I'm looking for money for education for women. That I was doing it, she wouldn't agree.
Right. Well, let's see how you get on now.
Right.
Because you are here to talk about En Cassant, and this is about Marion's legacy. This was one of her passions. Yeah. Tell us about En Cassant.
Well, it's not so much En Cassant as the Community Foundation, which is an umbrella thing who funds all sorts of small community work all over Ireland. Marion used to present the prizes there every year for people who beaver away in small towns doing small things. We all know about Meals and Wheels and all that sort of stuff. But tiny things who are not recognised, but in my opinion and hers, were the cement of Irish society, you know. She used to give those. And they rang me and they said, we would like to put up a bursary or some idea in remembrance of this. So go away and think about it. And strangely enough, I thought a lot about it, and Marion was absolutely passionate about education for women. And everywhere we travelled, all over the world, if you could get the women into school, you know, it was simple as that. Educate a woman and you educate a family, educate a man and he gets a job. And it's not a feminist issue, it's a fact, you know. And we've seen it everywhere. And so then, fast forward, Marion used to present the prize in on Cusson, which is for women going back to school. And by bizarre, the world is strange. We met Liz O'Donnell in Cusson when she was a junior minister, and I said to her, do you know anything about Africa? And that started our African odyssey. And I was staggered. There were women in their 30s and 40s there with tears in their eyes after getting their leaving cert or their intercert, you know.
At On Cusson,
yeah.
When Marion was presenting the awards
to these prizes,
them. Yeah.
You know. So as far as I was concerned, I came back to it, education. She was passionate. And in the schools, we started up in African, and she hauled in the women all the time, mm-hmm. you know. And so I thought, right, education it is. And I knew a lot of the women who did or didn't go to On Cusson. And by the way, there's a lot of adult education places all over Ireland. You know, this is not just for Tala. And it's to give a group of women back their self-respect. And just to be sure that I knew what I was talking about, a bit of what I've been holding with friends, workshops all over, people who went back to school or who are disadvantaged, you know. And the big driving force for women, or the difficulty of getting them into school, is lack of self-esteem. And I remember one woman who, her 10-year-old, asked her to do the homework with, and she couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And she just said, I'll ask your teacher. And she said to us, I feel like wallpaper. And I thought, you can't get much lower than that.
That's John Clark, husband of the late Marion Finucane, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about On Cusson's new bursary fund in memory of Marion, for which he's fundraising. Further information from oncusson.ie. That's oncusson.ie. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Níl Óisiúrádán. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. But for me, thank you for listening and good luck.